We are studying Christian ethics, and we come this morning to an issue that is a particular concern to our society, and that is prejudice. Our society is very concerned about racism, sexism, classism, and things like that. The Bible takes all those isms and lumps them all together into one term, and that is favoritism. What the world talks about when it is talking about racism or prejudice and all that is under the category in Scripture of favoritism. And the key passage is James 2. James chapter 2, verse 1, "My brothers, don't mix your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the glory, with favoritism. They're incompatible. Suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing many gold rings and fine clothes, and a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, 'Here's a good seat for you,' but say to the poor man, 'Stand there or sit here at my feet,' have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" Favoritism, the definition of favoritism is this. Favoritism is judging by the wrong criteria. And there's two kinds of favoritism. There's unjust favoring and unjust judging. And they're both condemned. We usually only worry about unjust judging. We're very concerned about unjust judging. But unjust favoring is also wrong, and that's the emphasis in this text. Unjust favoring refers to giving preferential treatment based on invalid criteria. Giving people preferred treatment for wrong reasons, like appearance or wealth or something like that. And it's always rooted in selfishness. Favoritism is selfishness. You give someone special treatment because you want to gain some advantage with that person, right? Maybe it isn't money. Usually it's money. You give special treatment to people who are rich because you're hoping to get some of the money. But it could be just the person's favor. Maybe it's not money. Maybe you're showing favoritism to somebody just because you are attracted to that person or something about that person. You want them to be favorable towards you, and so in order to win their favor, you show them good treatment. When Tracy and I were looking for an apartment one time when we were first married, we went on a Saturday, and we had been working, and we went in our work clothes, just our shabby clothes, to look at apartments. And we went to this one, and were made to wait 20 minutes and told after the 20 minutes that we needed to make an appointment. We couldn't see the apartment without making an appointment. So we made an appointment, and this other time was a Sunday afternoon, so we went right after church. And I was wearing a suit, Tracy was wearing a dress, her real nice clothes, and they instantly took care of us. The owner dropped everything she was doing and came and talked to us, and they showed us everything we wanted and gave us some refreshments. And this wasn't at our appointment time. This is just a random Sunday. And we said, "Do we need to make an appointment?" "Oh, no, no, not necessary." It's just because of the clothes we were wearing. It's amazing if you do that, if you ever want to do an experiment. Just put on a suit and then go walk through Walmart. Just go anywhere, and you'd be amazed the difference in the way you're treated. In the church, favoritism doesn't come from wealth as much as from attractiveness. We favor people who are physically or socially attractive to us, attractive people. People who are skilled at socializing, fun to talk to, fun to be around. We tend to give preferred treatment to those people. Think about the difference in the way that you greet you, just in your own heart. Think about the way you greet a newcomer who's attractive and easy to talk to, compared with a newcomer who's socially inept, ugly, whatever. One thing that stuck out about Jesus was that he never showed favoritism. He was known for that. Even his enemies admitted that. Luke 20, Mark 12, Matthew 22, they said, "One thing about you, we know for sure, is you absolutely never show favoritism." They were just astonished at how he treated everyone the same. So unjust favoring is wrong, and then unjust judging, of course, is wrong, and that's bigotry. Just as it's wrong to give preferred treatment unjustly, it's wrong to judge people with the wrong criteria. When Matthew 7:1 says, "Judge not," what does that mean? That gets it's quoted a lot, misquoted a lot, misapplied a lot. It doesn't, obviously, can't forbid us from making any evaluation of a person whatsoever, because just a few verses later, he calls us to judge. We have to discern who's a dog or a swine that we're not supposed to throw our pearls before. So we need to make discernment judgments about people. Matthew goes on to say that you will be judged by the standard you use. If you use a biblical standard, then there's no problem. But the problem is when you use a wrong standard, an invalid criterion for judging. That's what's forbidden. If I say Robert Shuler is not a Christian or Oprah Winfrey is not a Christian, that is not improper judging. Those two particular people don't believe the gospel, and so if you call them a non-Christian, you're not passing judgment. You're just simply restating a judgment that God has already passed, something the Bible already says. Anybody who rejects the gospel isn't a Christian. On the other hand, if you say, hey, look at that guy. He looks like a bum. You know, he smokes. He's not saved. Or something like that. Those are invalid criteria. And it's wrong to judge people based on wrong criteria. Because that's a judgment that God never passed. In this passage here, when it says a poor man, it's talking about a destitute beggar, a bum, really, is what it's talking about. Tokos is the word. It's the total loser of society. And if you give him any different treatment than a wealthy man that comes into the church, then you're judging by means of externals, and that's an invalid criterion. You tell him to sit on the floor. The idea here is that for a non-appealing person, our attitude is usually, You can be around my life and sit here at my feet and be over there or whatever you can, but you cannot be a part of my life. Just keep your distance. That's the way we tend to treat people that are not appealing to us. So that's kind of just a summary of what the biblical teaching is on the issue. Now, let me also mention just quickly about the difference between prejudice and discrimination. In our culture, discrimination and prejudice have become synonyms. They mean almost exactly the same thing, but in reality, they're very different ideas. Prejudice is wrong, but there's nothing inherently bad about discrimination, and that's what our culture can't seem to understand. Discrimination acknowledges differences, which is fine. And there's all kinds of discrimination that's good discrimination. The United States government discriminates against children when they have the law that says you have to be 35 years old to be the president. They're discriminating against children. They're not allowing any children to be present. Schools discriminate against adults when they say you had to be 5 years old to be in kindergarten. Right? That's discrimination. Every time you make any decision at all, you discriminate against all the options that you didn't choose. Discrimination is not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with it. What's bad is discrimination based on invalid criteria. Prejudice, on the other hand, is always bad because prejudice is when you assume bad things about an entire class of people, entire category of people. That's not to say it's wrong to make all generalizations. It's not. I don't think there's anything wrong with generalizing about groups. If you say this particular society, when they're evil, tend to be evil in this way, this particular people group tend to have this problem, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that generalization. What's wrong is when you assume one particular individual out of that group is evil and has those evil characteristics just because they're in that group. That's what's prejudice. So, there's nothing wrong with acknowledging statistically, for example, that Native Americans tend to have a high percentage of drunks among them. That's just a fact. But if you meet a Native American and assume that he's a drunk because he's a Native American, that would be prejudice. The scriptural instruction regarding just treatment of the powerless person in society is very, very clear, very emphatic. We are not to be unjust towards people just because they are from some group. It doesn't matter the group. We tend to treat people poorly because they're from some other group. In ancient Israel, and God knew that. God knew the alien, the person from some other culture is going to tend to be mistreated as soon as he comes into Israel's company, and so he made all kinds of laws about that. He knew they would be marginalized in Jewish culture, and God says, no, he's to be treated well. He's to be treated just like everyone else. He's to be fully incorporated with the law of love to your neighbor and in the social community, Exodus 23:9. He's to be treated equally before the law, Exodus 12:49. He's to be included in all the religious life, Exodus 12:48-49. Part of the reason God brought such terrible judgment on Israel is because of their poor treatment of foreigners. Because they were mean to foreigners. Jeremiah 7, Jeremiah 22, Ezekiel 22, Zechariah 10, Malachi 3. All those passages say that. God set himself to be a protector of the minority person. Numbers 15:15. So, that's kind of some background. Now let's talk about racism first. Racism is a relatively recent problem. Throughout history, sinful man has always mistreated and looked down on people who are from a different culture. if you want to call that culturalism or something like that. That's nothing new. But the idea that there's not one single human race, but that humanity is divided up into different human races, and some are higher and some are lower, is only a problem that basically became widespread as Darwinism came into vogue. Darwinism is really the foundation of all racism, almost all racism. In fact, the full title of Darwin's book is The Origin of the Species, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. It's all about races. Probably the most famous and influential evolutionist today is Stephen Jay Gould. And even Gould admits this. Listen to this quote from Gould. Biological arguments for racism may have been common before 1859, but they increased by orders of magnitude following the acceptance of evolutionary theory. I mean, it just can't be argued. For most of history, it was believed that there's only one race of humans. We're all the same race. Skin color is just an incidental point of variety within the human race, like hair color. But once Darwinism took hold, virtually all 19th century evolutionists held to the theory of superior and inferior races. And the result of that was social Darwinism, which saw the elimination of less evolved races of humans at the hands of the more evolved races of humans as a good thing. If the stronger ones kill off the weaker ones, the survival of the fittest, that advances evolution, it's a good thing. More and more politicians and leaders and more writers began to accept the idea that war was inevitable, natural, and beneficial for weeding out the inferior races. And there's a fair consensus now among historians that that was one of the many causes of World War I, that mindset. A common sentiment in the day is reflected in this quote from Anthropological Review. I'll just read you a quote, and you get the idea of the way that people were thinking. It says, as the type of Negro is fotal, I don't know what, I didn't bother to look that up, but whatever. You don't need to know that. As the type of Negro is fotal, so that the Mongol is infantile, and in strict accordance with this, we find that their government, literature, and art are infantile also. They are beardless children whose life is a task and whose chief virtue consists in unquestioning obedience. In other words, they're good for slavery. And a lot of these quotes that I read say that they're better off as slaves, because that's basically what they're for. That's what's best for them, because that's what they're designed for. Evolutionism was taken to its logical conclusion by Adolf Hitler. Listen to this quote and see if you can guess who made this. See if you can guess if this is Charles Darwin or Adolf Hitler. The civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. The civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. Races of man. That's not Hitler. That's Charles Darwin in The Descent of Man. And the reason I tell you that is this. When I start bringing up Hitler and saying Hitler brought evolutionism to its natural conclusion, Darwinists will always react and say, no, Hitler was a perversion of evolution and Darwinism. It's not Darwin's fault that some psychopath comes along and twists and perverts his ideas any more than it's Jesus' fault when some perverse people kill and murder in the name of God. You know, that happens with every theory. But the reason I don't buy that is because social Darwinism, which says that the strong races should kill off the weaker races, is not a perversion of Darwinism. The first social Darwinist was Charles Darwin. And that quote I read proves it. The civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. He foresaw that. He knew that was the logical conclusion of his theory. And he knew that there were social implications. And let me go on. Let me read you the rest of his quote. He went on to say, at the same time, the anthropomorphous apes, which are the apes that are closer to man, they look more like a man, will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man and a more civilized state, as we may hope, even than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as the baboon, instead of now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla. The point that he's making is, right now there's barely a gap between the animals and man, because you get the gorilla right here, and right above that, the Australian or the Negro. And once we kill off all the Negroes and Australians, And once all the gorillas die out, then you'll have a nice wide gap between Caucasians and baboons. That's Darwin. That's exactly what Hitler was doing. There's no difference between that and what Hitler's theory was. And I read a lot of Hitler. I read a lot of Mein Kampf. You can just get on the internet, and it's in English, and you can just read it. And it's all there. It's just filled with it. Thomas Huxley was the primary one who popularized Darwinism in Darwin's day. And Thomas Huxley said this, quote, "No rational man, cognizant of the facts, believes that the average Negro is the equal of the white man. And if this be true, it is simply incredible that when all his disabilities are removed, the Negro will be able to compete successfully with his bigger-brained and smaller-jawed rival." He says there's no way that's going to happen. "In a contest which is to be carried out by thoughts and not bites." What he's saying is, now that the fight between the whites and blacks is based on intelligence and not on biting, we're going to win, the blacks are going to lose. That's Huxley. Hitler's philosophy was not a perversion of that. It was evolutionism in its purest form. And if you ever doubt that's what drove Hitler and his beliefs, just read Mein Kampf. It's absolutely everywhere. I'll read from page 285. Hitler says, "No more than nature desires the mating of weaker with the stronger individuals, even less does she desire the blending of the higher with the lower races. Since, if she did, her whole work of higher breeding over perhaps hundreds of thousands of years might be ruined with one blow." You got some less evolved race like the Jews or blacks intermarrying with Aryan Germans. You just wiped out hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary progress in one generation. He went on to say, quote, "Historic evidence offers countless proofs of this. It shows with terrifying clarity that in every mingling of Aryan blood with that of the lower peoples, the result was the end of the cultured people. North America, whose population consists the largest part of Germanic elements, who mixed but little with the lower colored peoples, shows a different humanity and culture. All great cultures of the past perished only because the original creative race died out from blood poisoning. This preservation is bound up with the rigid law of necessity and the right to victory of the best and the stronger in the world. Those who want to live, let them fight, and those who do not want to fight in this world of eternal struggle do not deserve to live. Fight for your survival. You can't fight, then you don't deserve to live. Survival of the fittest is the rule for this world." That's Hitler. And people often wonder how Hitler managed to get a whole country to go along with him. You can understand the homicidal maniac popping up here and there, but how did Hitler manage to get what was arguably the most well-educated culture of the day to go along with his ideas? He did it by persuading them of his ideas through Mein Kampf, his book. He argued for evolution in Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf became one of the most widely read books in German history. The German population was not just a bunch of oblivious blind sheep following a charismatic leader. 11 million of them went out and forked over the money for a copy of Mein Kampf in 1 year, in 1944 alone. 11 million copies of that book sold. So, oh, and by the way, and I'll just throw this in. This is off subject, but let me just throw this in. I've told you many times that most of the headway being made today against evolution in the scientific world is being made by those who are arguing only against naturalistic evolution. They're not arguing for creationism necessarily. People like Behe and Philip Johnson, they're not arguing for pure creationism. They're just trying to argue that God had to be involved in some way. It's okay if you believe in evolution as long as you believe in theistic evolution, that God helped the process along. That's what a lot of these people are shooting for, convincing the world of. They say, if we can take that step at least then we get people believing in God. But if they succeed in that, if they succeed in convincing absolutely every scientist in the world of theistic evolution, that God created by means of evolution, what good would that do? What good would that do? Did you know that Hitler was a theistic evolutionist? I was surprised to read this. I didn't know this, but I was reading Mein Kampf. He believed in a beneficent, bountiful creator. Hitler was a creationist. in chapter 1 of Mein Kampf, he said, whoever would dare raise profane hand against the high image of God among his creatures, that's the Aryan race, would sin against the bountiful creator of his marvel and would collaborate with the expulsion from paradise. Chapter 2, on the state, he said, the state is given a very high mission, indeed, to preserve and encourage the highest type of humanity which a beneficent creator has bestowed on this earth. Hitler could have read Darwin's Black Box, Darwin on Trial, all these anti-evolution books that are so popular now, and he wouldn't have had any problem with anything in there. He would have agreed totally. He would have read it and said, of course there had to be a creator. I understand that. But the fact that he believed the creator used evolution as a good thing is what justified Hitler's use of the evolutionary process in order to exterminate the lower races, what he regarded as the lower races. And the result of that is Hitler gave social Darwinism and racism a bad name. And so now it's really frowned on by culture, and the world has reacted against it. So most modern evolutionists are kind of like the Mormons in that one of their main doctrines became socially unacceptable, and so they dropped it. And that's the doctrine of racism. However, I have yet to meet an evolutionist who can explain to me what was wrong with Hitler's philosophy. Because according to evolutionism, he was right on target. If suffering and death and the survival of the fittest and painful destruction of the weakest is God's good plan of creation, then what argument can be made against continuing that? And those strong ones killing off the weak ones. But if evolution is not true and the biblical account of creation is, then there's only one race of humans. And that, in that case, racism becomes sheer stupidity. Because if you're against any race of humans, there's only one race, so you'd be against the whole race. If humans evolved, then the ones who are farther along are superior, right? You can't argue with that. If evolution is true, then whoever's evolved the most is superior. But if humans were created fully human, then there is no such thing as a superior or inferior human being. And that's the biblical standard. In fact, the Bible forbids us from considering anybody inferior. The Bible even forbids Christians as to even have an attitude of superiority. Philippians 2:4. So should skin color matter? That's really a tricky question. It's not as much of a slam dunk question as you think, because it used to be that the civil rights leaders argued that we should be completely colorblind. A person should be judged by the strength of his character, not the color of his skin. Right? That was Martin Luther King's dream. Now it's come full circle. And most of the high-profile civil rights leaders today are arguing that skin color should be taken into consideration. They argue that it's racist to be colorblind. Because if you're colorblind, and you treat everyone exactly the same, the reason that's racist is because they'll say blacks were given such poor treatment in the past that in order to make up for that, need to be given better treatment now than everyone else gets in order to make up for those disadvantages that they're suffering now as a result of their mistreatment in the past. Now think about that argument. Is that a biblical idea to help somebody out now who's in distress because of poor treatment in the past? Absolutely. No question about it. If somebody has been treated poorly in the past, then does it make sense to give them extra care now? Yes. Yes. However, where their argument goes wrong is by saying that we should give that extra good treatment based on skin color, which is an invalid criterion for judging somebody. Should we help people who've been mistreated? Yes, but skin color alone is not a valid criterion for someone who's worthy of help. Every person, lots of people were treated poorly in the past. Lots of people. Everyone should be treated as a person. Skin color is no more relevant than hair color or shoe size or blood type. And if anybody's been mistreated in the past, they should be helped now. The other thing I want to address is the idea of segregation in the church, because recently the church has begun to become very concerned with racism. And Promise Keepers has made racial reconciliation one of its highest priorities. And most of the major denominations have made a major point of it. I know the E-Free had a whole convention about it. From what I can tell, the approach that they've taken isn't doing much other than just producing guilt and convincing people that they're racist when they didn't think they were racist. The pastor of the church, I'll just give you one example. The pastor of the church Tracy and I used to attend, he went to that conference and came back, all worked up about racial reconciliation, and he said, I never thought I had a racist bone in my body. I didn't think that I was racist. But I went to this thing and I found out I am racist. Because the example he gave is there are certain parts of town that I'm afraid to drive through, and I'll drive around those parts of town. Well, that's not racism. If certain areas of town are more dangerous, they're more dangerous, and it's wise to avoid them. Regardless of the color of the skin of the people who live there, it doesn't matter. If there's a dangerous part of town where people are doing dangerous things, it's not racist to avoid that. They're dangerous, not because of the color of their skin. In fact, the very premise is, I think, racist in that it's saying the reason that place is dangerous is because, what? Blacks live there. That's ridiculous. The reason that place is dangerous is because the kind of people, the people that live in that area have certain influences that cause them to be dangerous people. And if you notice, the whites there are just as dangerous as the blacks. It's a dangerous part of town, and all the people there are in that category. There's something about the area and the culture in that area that breeds that. It has nothing to do with skin color. I've heard it said many times that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America, meaning the church is racist because we segregate the white churches and black churches apart. I don't believe that the fact that most churches are either all white or all black, or mostly white or mostly black, I don't think that's evidence of racism, and I disagree with the use of the word segregation to describe that. I don't think we're segregated. Using a term like that implies that churches are somehow forbidding certain people from attending. And that might be true somewhere in the lunatic fringe, some racist churches, I suppose. But I've never seen it. Tracy and I were, I'll give you an example. Tracy and I were looking for church when we moved to Colorado Springs. And we were walking through this parking lot one night, I think it was a Sunday night. And we heard this incredible singing, worship music. And we thought, wow, what is that? That's great. So we followed this sound to this building, and there's this massive church. These people were in there having their worship time. And we went in. Oh, how many people? Do you remember how many people? This must have been 700-800 people in there. Several hundred, anyway. It might have been 300 or 400 or 500. But anyway, it was a lot. It was a lot of. And we walked in there. And when we came in, that we realized right away that there were hundreds of blacks and two whites. And it was the two whites were me and Tracy. And so you got a church that's all black people in a city where there are more white people than black people. How do you explain that? Is that evidence that they must have segregationist policies in that church? No, and I can say that for sure, that these people weren't racist in any way, because I can say without equivocation that of all the churches we visited in Colorado Springs, that one was had to be the by far the friendliest and most welcoming, wouldn't you say? To us. They were absolutely welcoming to us. They didn't push us away in any way. They didn't make us feel uncomfortable. We felt very comfortable. We didn't end up joining, however, because I didn't care for the preaching. But that didn't have anything to do with the skin color. I just didn't like the way he preached. People tend to divide into culturally similar groups, and that's not wrong. I think that those people were in that church not because of wanting to be away from whites. I think they were in that church because they liked the style of worship and the style of preaching. They just liked that culture that was there. And my guess is that if there were mostly white people there, and yet it was the exact same style of worship and same style of preaching, all those same people would still be attracted to it, those same black people. Because we like what we're used to. We like our culture, and that's not bad. When the people who like that style come into Creekside, and they're used to a preacher, for example, who's into hooping, they get a little bored when they hear me. It might put them to sleep. It doesn't have anything to do with racism. In fact, at Creekside, the leadership has talked a lot about our desire to have more ethnic variety at Creekside. There's a level, for example, of black churches. I don't know if you've ever been to a black church, but there's a level of energy in the worship that we would love to have here. And we would love to have a lot of that come in to infuse our church with that. But the solution to racism is not phony guilt trips on people convincing everybody that they're racist. The solution to racism is love. Love. It's seeing the image of God in people, all people, and elevating spiritual realities higher than earthly ones. The world can't do that. They can't rise above skin color and things like that because they can't understand spiritual realities. But the Christian says, you have different customs than me, so what? You have different practices than me, different worship style than me, different skin color, so what? None of that matters. What matters is if you're a brother or sister in Christ. If I discover that we worship the same God, the same Lord, has one faith, one Lord, one baptism, one God and Father of all, then I have an affection for you that's going to transcend anything else. So, I don't like the term racism. I'll still use it because that's just the accepted term. But the term racism implies there are different races of people and they're not. Despising somebody who's different from a different culture is discussed in the Bible, and that's sinful. It's always wrong just because a person is different. And there should be no animosity. It's not a bad thing that churches, the Christianity divides up into various cultural groups in churches. That's okay. But if there's some kind of division because of animosity, because of cultural differences, that's wrong. And if one group looks down on the other group as being somehow inferior, that's depraved. All right. Well, yeah. And the references were those things that I started out with. And I start out with them because they govern all three of these things we're talking about. The major one is the favoritism one. James 1:2-4 establishes the principle that any judging based on wrong criteria is invalid, and skin color obviously is a wrong criteria. Also, those other passages like Matthew 7, judge not, again, forbids judging on wrong criteria. And then all those passages in your notes on about how Israel was forbidden to mistreat foreigners. That's the major thing. Right before the heading racism there, about how foreigners were to be treated exactly the same as everyone else. That's where we're forbidden to treat people who are different in different ways. All right. Any other comments on racism? Okay. Classism. This you don't hear about very much, and yet I think is a far bigger problem in the church. And that's just another false criterion for judging people, aside from skin color, is financial and social status. The world will value you much, much more highly if you have more money or you're in a highly respected profession. You don't hear about this as being a big problem because the world isn't convinced it's wrong. This is the way they operate. And it should not infect the church. When we do things like make it real easy for an important business executive who gives huge offerings to become an elder, and we make it almost impossible for the guy who works at 7-Eleven to become an elder, that's classism. It's sin. It couldn't be denounced in clearer terms than in James 2. And I think it really is a big problem in the church. I think we tend to do this. We tend to not respect people who are lower class in society than people who are in a higher class. There's no slave or free in Christ anymore. Doesn't matter. There are no more classes. And we're also susceptible to class envy, which I just hate. And it's a huge problem in our culture. It's amazing that there's one particular strategy that a lot of politicians use in order to get votes or support for their thing, and that is to generate class envy. They'll say something benefits the rich, and by saying something benefits the rich, they instantly have huge millions of people against that thing, whatever it is, because if it benefits the rich, I'm against it. Because why? Because I hate the rich, because I have envy in my heart. I mean, that's the only reason. Why are we upset if somebody's going to profit? If something good is going to happen to somebody, that makes me against it? The only explanation for that is I have a prejudice against that category of people, right? That is sin. And I don't know if you're envious of rich people, but when you see somebody who has lots and lots and lots of money, the world would have you react to that person by saying, oh, he must be evil. He must that corporation has this much money, they must be evil. Those people with all this money, they're the cause of all these problems. That's sinful. To take an individual, just because he's a part of a certain group of people, to infer certain sins about him is wrong. And it's always wrong to be upset when somebody else prospers. That's an ugly sin of envy. And we should not be subject to that. We should be glad when other people prosper.
I think a lot of the media that focuses on, like, trashy, you know, showing all the problems of the rich and the famous and the is based on that.
Yeah.
That a lot of money is generated just by people wanting to look at someone else's.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and the media will do everything they can to highlight the evil ones who are rich, because that's not a protected group in our culture. It's okay to be against rich people. I mean, you can slander rich people and nobody will say anything about it. And so they do that, even though many of them are wealthy themselves. but it's any kind of envy is wrong. And then the last category is sexism. Ever since the curse, there's been an animosity between males and females. And the curse in Genesis 3, God said to the woman, "Your desire will be to dominate your husband, but he will despotically rule over you." And ever since that, the world has seen women seeking to dominate men, only to face chauvinism and brutality from men in return. And that's been the fight. And I don't have to detail for you the latter. Women have been horribly mistreated throughout the centuries by men. That's obvious. It still goes on most of the world today, especially in the Muslim world, but everywhere in the world. And the reason for that is very simple. The reason for male chauvinism and mistreatment of women is men have sinful, depraved hearts, and they're physically stronger. And you combine those two things, and you get trouble for the one who's weaker. If somebody's stronger than you, and they have a depraved heart, then you're in trouble. On the other hand, there have also always been feminist movements, which are also sinful, that have come from the other side of the curse, the woman's desire to dominate the man. Now, when I say, don't misunderstand, when I say that feminism is wrong, there's nothing wrong with women seeking just treatment. There's nothing wrong with women seeking fair treatment under the law and kind treatment from men in general. That's fine. That's fine. That's good. And a lot of women call themselves feminists just because they seek those things, and that's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about feminism. Throughout the history, I mean, that's fine. What I'm saying that throughout history has existed that's bad in feminism is this thing that arises out of the curse of wanting to dominate men and being against men. Every Christian should be, and every decent person should be kind and just in their treatment of women. But feminism has tended to go way beyond that into reasoning that all male, or resenting all male leadership and all male authority and rebelling against it and having a rebellious attitude against it. Our world resents authority in general. That's just the way they are. But women are especially conditioned in our culture to resent male authority over them. And so we read in the Bible, children, be submissive and respectful to your parents. And it doesn't cause any controversy. Everything's fine. Everyone says, oh, that's great. And children understand that. And then we read in 1 Peter 5, young men, be submissive to the older men in the church. That's fine. I can preach that all day long. Nobody gets ruffled. There's no crisis. Nobody writes letters. You know, there's very little maybe a little grumbling here and there, but pretty much it's okay. Then we read, everyone, be submissive to and respectful to the government authorities. And we can deal with that. But then we read, wives, be submissive and respectful to your husbands. Or, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man in the church. And the response is, what? You've got to be kidding! And the world will always have its battle of the sexes, but it's wrong for that to infect the church. The church should be a place where the men cherish the women and treat them with the greatest gentleness and respect, and where the women look up to the men and have a gentle, quiet, submissive, respectful spirit that is of great worth in the eyes of the Lord, 1 Peter 3. And that's not sexism. It's not sexism to recognize differences. It is sinful for a man to think of a woman as being inferior to him. But it is not sinful for a man to think of a woman as being different from him and having different roles. We're in the process of dividing up responsibilities right now among the leadership and the deacons. And we're going to give some tasks to elders, some tasks to deacons, male deacons, some tasks to the deaconesses. There's nothing wrong with matching up the task that's most suited to that group. We're not going to just randomly divide up the tasks. For example, an issue that we addressed recently, things that involve relational issues the women tend to be generally better suited than the men to handle that. And so we want their input on that. On the other hand, on the basis of 1 Timothy 2:14, hermeneutical difficulties would be assigned to the men to work through. That's not sexism. It's just an appreciation of the responsiveness to the God-given roles that we see in Scripture. So, it's wrong to have animosity and negative thoughts towards the opposite sex in relationship to roles that God has established. Those roles should be...
Before I was a Christian, when I was in college, I was surprised all the time how feminism is so connected to abortion, too.
Isn't that something?
That in order for women to want... That's always a right, that's always... Because I've always been pro-life even before I was a Christian. And they never... It's so tied into it.
That's right. It's like their number one dogma is to be pro-abortion if you're a feminist. Which is interesting. It seems to me a contradiction, but I guess there's a thought in a lot of the feminist movement of today that's kind of, it almost seems like women who resent their role in reproduction, you know, they don't like anything that makes them different from men. It's just I've never understood it. This whole idea of you men are a bunch of chauvinist pigs, number one, and number two, we're exactly like you. We're equal to you in every way. And those two things, where there's this, you know, this despising of men on the one hand, and then this effort to be the same as men, and I just can't.
Here's some of the most bizarre ideas about. In one class, I was arguing with somebody. She said that there was like nothing biological to me wanting to have a baby. That there's nothing biological, but we're just programmed and...
That's right, it's all... Right.
But yet we should be above, I don't know, above the law.
People that think that way... Only people that haven't had kids think that way. People that think that all the difference between male and female are learned by society, those are people that haven't had kids. You have kids and you don't... nobody thinks that way after they have some boys and girls because... There's so many. Those differences are so early. You know, just when they're first crawling, you see them. Girls, you know, the one difference between males and females is females tend to have their brain is more developed in the area of communication. Now, some women's ability to communicate keeps developing and developing to where it gets out of hand. But you can see that way back when just little kids, you know, just our kids, when the girls were just, before they could talk, they would still articulate in a way like they're pretending they're talking. Josiah has been talking for years now, but still most of the sounds that come out of his mouth are not words. They're sound effects. You know, everything's an airplane or a bomb or, you know, a machine gun or something. That's just the way boys and girls are. There's this little baby blues. If you ever read that comic Baby Blues, you know that they've had kids because it's always right on. And there's one of those where they have a little girl and a little boy, and there's toys on the floor. The man and the wife are sitting on their couch, and all of a sudden the little boy crawls over and picks up a Barbie, and the mother is kind of looking and smiling, and the father's looking and frowning, and it's like, what is he doing? And then the last frame. He's taking this Barbie and it's a truck and and the father's smiling, the mother's frowning. That's the way it is. Everything. Josiah, you give him a Barbie, he'd love to play with Barbies, but it would be a gun. He'd take the leg down, make a trigger, and.
Dotson said on one of his talks on the radio that if you don't give a little boy a gun, he'll take his bread and bite it in the shape of a gun.
Yeah, and if you think that's learned, I thought a lot of it must be learned because how would a boy naturally know about guns since guns haven't even existed through most of history? But I'll tell you, when Josiah was just a toddler, way before he could talk, he used to do this thing where he would take a butter knife or something like that. And he would point, he'd close one eye and he'd point it at us in a funny way. And we didn't know what he was doing. Now this is, we didn't have a TV, we didn't have TV reception in Oklahoma, so TV wasn't a problem. We never watched TV. Josiah hadn't seen TV. He'd never seen TV. And he didn't have any toy guns. He had, you know, he was just a baby. He just had balls and things like that. And so he hadn't been around guns at all. He had no exposure to that. And yet he would do that, and we didn't know what he was doing. He would do it with a pencil. He'd do it with anything he picked up. He'd point it like that and close one eye. And I was curious one day. So one time he did that, and I kind of went like, oh, you know, like he shot something at me or something. And he's like, he's finally, you understand what I'm doing. He just absolutely loved that. It was his favorite game, you know. And guns haven't always existed, but there's always been a way to project something, you know, across the room. And men love that, you know. That is born. That is in our genes. So, okay. Well, any other comments about it?
One out of our three daughters is like that, though. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's not. It's not. These are generalities. They're generalities, but they're true nonetheless. Okay. Let's close in word of prayer. Father, on that note, we really do rejoice in the differences between men and women. Lord, I am so thrilled with the wonderful completeness that comes to humanity in the image of God through the creation of women, and I'm so glad that you did it the way you did it, and that we're not in that bad condition where Adam was in of not having women. And I pray that you'd help us to appreciate those things more and more, even though they do create difficulties for us in marriage and things like that. Still, there's such beauty to it. So we thank you. Help us to not be prejudiced. Help. I pray that you would keep any kind of favoritism out of our lives, that we might look at people and see the image of God and nothing else. We pray this in your holy name. Amen.